As we moved into Judges chapter 4 last week, we encountered the female Shophet judge, Deborah. And the judges discussed in the chapters before Deborah dealt with the idolatrous rebellions of the tribes of Israel that were generally located in the southern end, geographically, of the Promised Land. And so the enemies from the south and the southwest and the southeast troubled those particular Israelite tribes that lived down there. With the judge Deborah, the scene now shifts to the northern end of the Promised Land, of Canaan, and the Israelite tribes who lived up there. So it was the Canaanites and others whose kingdoms and nations were located to the north and to the northeast that created havoc for those particular Israelite tribes. Now note that as a result of this, this southern versus northern picture that is painted for us, it means that when we look at the list of Shoftim, judges, in the book of Judges, the order that they're presented in, appearing to be chronological, is likely only partially correct. Certainly, some judges in the south were operating at the same time as some judges were up in the north, so you have an overlap. This is because the various enemies of Israel were not acting in concert with one another, but each acted in their own interests. And so what went on in the north of Canaan didn't have much to do with what went on in the south. Now, I find it interesting that this north-south dynamic is being set up so early in Israel's history. Israel, by the time of Deborah, has only been in the land, the Promised Land, after the Exodus, for a century or a little more. But due to the natural terrain of Israel, with a ridge of hills at the northern end of Judah that provides a natural boundary between the three main tribes in the south, that's Judah, Simeon, and Benjamin, and the remaining tribes, this fact of geography was going to have an ongoing effect on Israel's politics and their economy and their prophetic futures. Now, I've taught rather extensively on the period following the Judges, when David and then Solomon ruled over a united nation of Israel. We find, for instance, that King Saul, who preceded David, had at least as big a fight on his hands, trying to unite all 12 tribes. The southern Israelite tribes were battling against the northern Israelite tribes. He had this difficult battle on his hands, trying to get all of Israel together as he did against the foreigners, because the Israelite tribes located at the two ends of Canaan tended to coalesce into two distinct groups of and sets of intertribal alliances. And so they progressed rather independently of each other. Thus, after King Solomon died, and there was no clear line of succession to the throne, the country of Israel fell rapidly into civil war. And of course, it divided along that same general boundary as had always existed for Israel, the rugged hills that separated Judah from Ephraim. Thus, from that time forward, we hear of the two kingdoms of Israel, the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom, their more official names, Judah in the south, and Ephraim, Israel, in the north. So it is here in Judges where we see the breeding ground created for the conditions that would establish and cement this north versus south mindset among the Israelites, which in turn would make it such a challenge for the 12 tribes to ever unite into one sovereign nation under God, under one ruler. These unintended consequences of divided loyalties and tribal alliances were going to greatly affect Israel's history, and it will continue to play out by the way, in our present and future. And this is revealed to us in the book of Ezekiel. And all of it was ordained as part of Yahweh's master plan of redemption for a fallen world. So let's read some of Judges chapter 4 to get our bearings for today. Open your Bibles to Judges chapter 4. And let's see, that's going to be on page 273, I believe, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Nope, it's going to be 274 because we're going to start with verse 4. Judges chapter 4, starting with verse 4. 274 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Now, Devorah, a woman and a prophet, the wife of Lapidot, was judging Israel at that time, and she used to sit under Devorah's palm between Ramah and Beit El in the hills of Ephraim. And the people of Israel would come to her for judgment, and she sent for Barak, the son of Avinoam, from Kadesh and Naphtali, and said to him, Adonai has given you this order. Go march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the people of Naphtali and Zebulun. I will cause Sisera, the commander of Yavin's army, to encounter you at the Kishon River with his chariots and his troops, and I will hand him over to you. And Barak answered her, if you go with me, I'll go, but if you won't go with me, I won't go. She replied, yes, I will gladly go with you, but the way you are doing it will bring you no glory, because Adonai will hand Sisera over to a woman. Then Deborah set out and went with Barak to Kadesh. While Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali to come to Kadesh, 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah went up with him. Now, Hevera the Kenite, the Keni, had cut himself off from the rest of Cain, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' father-in-law. He had pitched his tent near the oak at Zanaim, which is close to Kadesh. Now, Sisera was informed that Barak, the son of Avinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera rallied his chariots, all 900 iron chariots, all the troops he had with him from Harosheth HaGoyim to the Kishon River. And Deborah said to Barak, get going. This is the day when Adonai will hand Sisera over to you. Adonai has gone out ahead of you. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and Adonai threw Sisera, all of his chariots, and his entire army into a panic before Barak's sword, so that Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army all the way to Harosheth HaGoyim. Sisera's entire army was put to the sword. Not one man was left. However, Sisera ran on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Hever the Keni, because there was peace between Yavin, the king of Hazor, and the family of Hever the Keni. Yael, that's Jael, went out to meet Sisera and said to him, come in, my lord, stay here with me, don't be afraid. So he went into her tent, and she covered him over with a blanket, and he said to her, please, give me a little water to drink, I'm thirsty. Well, she opened a goat skin of milk and gave him some to drink and covered him up again. And he said to her, stand at the entrance to the tent, and if anyone asks you if somebody is in here, say no. But when he was deeply asleep, Yael, the wife of Hever, took a tent peg and a hammer in her hand and crept into him quietly and drove the tent peg into his temple, right through to the ground, so that he died without waking up. So here is Barak pursuing Sisera, and Yael steps out to meet him and says, come, I'll show you the man you're looking for. He goes into her tent, and there is Sisera lying dead with a tent peg through his temple. Thus God on that day defeated Yavin, the king of Canaan, in the presence of the people of Israel. The hand of the people of Israel came down more and more heavily against Yavin, the king of Canaan, until they had completely destroyed Yavin, the king of Canaan. Now Deborah was unique among the Shoftim, as she was a bench judge and a prophetess. Verse 5 explains her location as being in the hills of Ephraim, meaning she operated among the northern tribes of Israel. Now, what's kind of hidden here is that by some non-stated reason, Deborah was revered by most, if not all, the tribes and clans of the north, such that they would come to her to settle serious legal disputes. Now, this was not merely advice. These weren't suggestions that were being sought by the disputes. This was not anything like that. Each tribe had their equivalent of lower courts that settled routine matters. But when a member of one tribe had a dispute with a member of another tribe, the matter became more complicated as clan and tribal loyalty overruled almost all other considerations. So finding a neutral party to arbitrate and to judge was never very easy. The matter of Deborah being a prophetess also played a role in her judging, and likely it was this general acknowledgement that she had been anointed by God as his legitimate prophet that gave her an uncontested position of authority to make legal rulings. Thus, in verse 5, in typical prophet protocol, she announces an oracle from God by making it clear that this message is not her message as a wisdom teacher, but rather it's directly from God. And this typical format is to say something to effect of, well, the Lord says, or Adonai has given you this order, or here's what the God of Israel says, and then proceeds to speak what must have been a near, if not precise, word-for-word instruction from Jehovah that is almost always in the first person. In other words, the instruction says, I, the Lord. The I is never the prophet, but it's always a direct quote from God. Now, it's kind of funny that last week and this week in our earlier class on Revelation, this dicey subject of prophets has popped up. I'm not sure what God's doing here, but there's this convergence, and I don't know if it's somebody or some people here or if it's those listening on the internet. Somebody needs to hear this, apparently. So I'm going to talk again about prophets. Especially modern-era prophets. And I'm just going to make a brief point, and then we're going to move on. Prophets of the Bible had a very rigid standard to meet. They had to be infallible. They had to be infallible in everything they pronounced. The consequence for being in error, death. No oops. If it does not happen as prophesied, then whether the source of the incorrect oracle was from that person's own mind or was prompted from the evil spiritual source, it certainly wasn't from God. Therefore, we have a false prophet. And never is a false prophet to be believed. So one test for a person who publicly professes a gift of prophecy is infallibility. One mistake, one pronouncement that doesn't happen. Oops, I got the date wrong, but I got the rest right. Doesn't work. And that person should realize they are not a prophet from God. Or they're grossly misusing their position. My email, I'm telling you, is flooded with people professing a word from the Lord for me. And I tend, interestingly, to keep track if a person might constantly hit the nail on the head and what is prophesied couldn't possibly be otherwise known by a human, and if it comports with Holy Scripture principles, because if that's the case, I want to hear what that person tells me, because it's from God. On the other hand, that person tells me that the Lord says that so-and-so is going to become president and it doesn't happen, or that a certain building is going to burn down next week, and it doesn't happen, or Israel is going to be attacked in July and nothing happens, I am never going to pay any further attention to that person's pronouncements, because they're in no ways a prophet from God. They're just a wannabe. And by the way, if this applies to anybody out there listening to me, and I get a hunch it does, beware. If what you have ever pronounced as being a message from the Lord has proved to be false, stop now and save yourself from a really harsh judgment, because you're misleading people. You're using God's name to do it. I'll tell you, being a prophet's a dangerous business when you're a true prophet. Being a false prophet can be fatal, physically and spiritually. So be very careful if you've ever developed this habit of telling people you have a word of the Lord for them, from the Lord for them. All right, be careful. Every last thing you say in that context had better come about, where you're working against God, even if you think you have good intentions. Being labeled a false prophet is one of the worst epithets the Bible can pronounce upon a person. All right, enough said about that. Now, in verses 6 and 7, Deborah, being a true divinely appointed, rather anointed prophet, simply relays the Lord's message to the military commander Barak with the specific details that he is to take 10,000 Israelite troops with him to Mount Tabor, and that these troops are to be from the two tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun. And there in the river valley below Mount Tabor, the Lord will cause the defeat of the enemy, as led by their military commander, Sisera. Now, the emphasis of the story shifts away from Deborah as God's messenger to Barak, the one who is commissioned to confront the enemy forces and carry out God's promise to hand over the enemy to him. It is Barak, not Deborah, who would be Jehovah's instrument to deliver the northern Israelites from the very oppression that God had influenced to happen, because it was a means of punishment for his people for their rebellious idolatry. Now, notice that Barak is from Kadesh. And I have said on a few occasions, Kadesh was a common city name all during the Bible era. And it was copied and used at several locations simultaneously. Now, apparently, this particular Kadesh was in the tribal territory of Naphtali, although there was another one located very near Mount Tabor that also could have been his home. Anyway, Barak was probably of the tribe of Naphtali, and consequently, the passage immediately mentions that the primary source of his army was Naphtali and Zebulun, although, as we'll find out later, other northern tribes also supplied some soldiers for this battle against Sisera. Now, more. The enemy's capital was the city of Hatzor. Yavin, king of Hatzor's royal city. Now, this was also in the tribal territory of Naphtali. So Barak was a very logical choice to command Israel's troops there. The Valley of Jezreel, which was very much a prize to be had if Israel could succeed against Sisera, was in Zebulun's territory. So it was to be expected then, from what I just told you, Naphtali and Zebulun would supply the most troops and be at the forefront of this oncoming battle. That said, the next chapter of Judges, chapter 5, does open the door slightly to the possibility that Barak was the tribe of Issachar, but nothing about that is certain. Well, the Kishon River at the foot of Mount Tabor was the second biggest river in Canaan, even though it generally was dry in the summertime. So it had the capacity to be a force in any battle, but it depended on the time of the year. It depended on the current conditions. Thus, we can guess that the Lord would supernaturally use it, as all of nature is under his control. And often nature is a prime weapon in his arsenal, which, by the way, although it's not politically correct to mention, is something we need to be aware of, as in our day we watch some blatantly evil anti-God affair of men come out to only be coincidentally followed by some catastrophic weather or naturally occurring event happen. There is a classic divine dichotomy set up here that we should be used to by now. It is the if-then dichotomy. That is, if a man or a people will do certain things in obedience to God, then God will respond with favor. And here it is that if Barak will lead 10,000 men to Mount Tabor and attack at the river Kishon, the foot of the mountain, then God will ensure a smashing victory. There is an interesting word usage here that is invariably masked by the English translations that adds to this if-then reciprocal action of man, then God. In verse 6, the Lord instructs Barak not to march his men to Mount Tabor, like it's often translated, same way in the complete Jewish Bible, but he is to mashach to Mount Tabor. Mashach means to draw, to influence his men to come. Barak's leadership and courage then would be the influential spark that would cause the downtrodden Israelites, downtrodden under years of Canaanite oppression, to rise up, follow him, and have hope for liberty that would then be put into action. So then in verse 7, God says in return, he will mashach, he will draw Sisera and his troops to come and do battle at the place God has ordained for their destruction, the Kishon River Valley. Now we Christians like to say to one another that the Lord never overrides a man's free will. But in fact, we see something similar to it all the time in the Bible when the Lord determines to do so. We saw the Lord harden Pharaoh's heart, causing him to make a destructive decision that he would not normally have done. We see here from a strategic standpoint that Sisera would do battle with a large force of Israelites who held the high ground, Mount Tabor. Usually a situation that when a general spots that, he avoids it militarily, even in today's high-tech military, if at all possible. And then later on in Revelation, we'll see God draw Israel's enemies from the north to this very same place, only to be annihilated by the saints of the Lord as led by our warrior King Messiah at the Battle of Armageddon. And in between all these passages, we're going to find many places where the Lord causes, he influences, he draws a man to do something he would not ordinarily do. Now, Barak responds to God's call through Devorah by saying he's a little bit skeptical about all this and has some preconditions. If he's going to accept this assignment, sounds a little bit like Moses, doesn't he? Now, no doubt, part of his skepticism is in not understanding why a very good military commander, very experienced, renowned military commander like Sisera would irrationally put his troops in an untenable position of being 1,000 feet below his opponents, the Israelites. His primary precondition then is that Deborah, who's pronouncing all this to him, says, okay, that's fine, you're telling me all this. Why don't you come along? You come with me. Now, we should not interpret this necessarily as cowardice, as Barak was anything but a coward. Rather, he wanted to be assured of God's presence and Deborah's presence as an assurance about all this. Well, Deborah tells Barak, okay, she'll go with him. But that as a consequence of his reluctance to simply believe God, then the glory of this victory is not going to go to the military commander, Barak, but instead it's going to go to a woman. Naturally, at this point, we all assume, as Barak probably did, that this woman was going to be Deborah, since now she'd be present at the battle and her notoriety would supersede that of even Barak's. Even more, it turns out that what is said about Sisera being handed over to a woman will turn out to be more literal than it appears. Because in this context, saying Sisera usually is referring to Sisera's army. Here it means that Sisera himself, personally, individually, will be handed over to a woman, although likely Barak didn't understand it that way. And of course, such a thing not only takes all the glory away from Commander Barak, but it also is greatly humiliating to Sisera, his army, and his nation that a woman, remember now this is a completely male-dominated society, well, this was going to, that she, a woman, would be the agent of his defeat. Well, verse 11 begins another angle on this story. It's about a group of people led by Hever, the Kenite. Now, the Kenites were a clan that belonged to the tribe of Midian. And this clan had a closer than usual attachment to Israel, because it was the clan of Moses' wife, Zipporah. Now, the Kenites were normally pro-Israel, to use a modern vernacular. But this particular sub-clan or extended family had broken away and either formed a direct alliance with Yavin of Hazor, king over the Canaanites, or informally agreed to inform on the movements of Israel to some degree or another, likely in return for being protected from oppression. The Kenite clan was located in Arad of the Negev. Now, this is even south of Judah, the southern kingdom. But here we find that Hever's family was up north, near the royal city of Hazor. So indeed, this separation of this family, Hever's family, from his clan was both political and geographical. In any case, while what Hever did was meant for evil against Israel, we're going to see that God was going to use it to bring about his will in this situation. So verse 12 begins the unfolding of how the battle actually went down. Hever informed Sisera that Barak had formed an army and he was heading for Mount Tabor. And just as Deborah's prophecy foretold, Sisera reacted by mustering his forces and leading them from a place called Harosheth HaGoyim, which means the woodlands of the Gentiles, to the Kishon River that ran along the base of Mount Tabor. Now, even though standard military tactics say that such a move is just foolhardy, Sisera was greatly confident in his enormous battalion of iron chariots, a most fearsome weapon that terrorized Israel. Certainly, even in his arrogance, Sisera knew that a muddy battlefield would essentially neutralize the advantage of chariots. So he must have expected a dry riverbed, firm ground. Likely, therefore, this battle was going to take place in the summertime when the river was dried up. Sisera was completely unaware that the Lord was setting a trap for him. Well, it's recorded in verse 14 now that Deborah encourages Barak and his troops by the call to action of get going. This is the day that Jehovah hands Sisera over to you. The context is such that she must have been at the plateau of Mount Tabor with Barak, because immediately Barak and his 10,000 soldiers rushed down that hill towards the ready and waiting Sisera and his formidable army with all those chariots. Well, located at the western end of the Jezreel Valley, the battle begins in earnest, but just as quickly something went terribly wrong for the Canaanite army, and they flew, we're told, into a panic. At this point, we're not told exactly what happened, but we'll get some more details in the next chapter, by the way, when we get there. The Canaanites began abandoning many of their chariots and running away on foot, as did their leader, Sisera. Now, the only reason to run instead of using a much faster team of horses attached to a chariot is the chariots were unable to move. Some of the chariots were able to escape, and as usual, the fleeing soldiers began to make their way back to their home base in this place called Harosheth HaGoyim. But Israel was in hot pursuit. The Hebrew soldiers caught up to Sisera's men, killed them all. The victory was not complete, however, because Sisera himself was still on the run. Now, Sisera obviously was taking a different route to safety than his men. While his army was trying to return to Harosheth HaGoyim, he was undoubtedly heading for the fortified royal city of Hazor. Well, the encampment of Hever the Kenite was apparently on the way to Hazor. And Sisera, knowing that this man was pro-Canaanite, stopped there to hide, to rest for a while. So as Sisera enters the tent village, he encountered Hever's wife, Yael. Yael means mountain goat. Now, wouldn't it be nice to name your daughter Mountain Goat? Think she'd appreciate that? Apparently she did. Hey, come here, Mountain Goat. That they lived in tents explains that their lifestyle was as nomads. They lived as the Bedouin do. Well, Middle Eastern custom greatly valued hospitality. But for nomads, hospitality was sanctified. The code of the Bedouin is such that they would give up their own lives to protect a guest, a friend, or a stranger. This was common knowledge. So Sisera knew what he was doing in coming to Hever's people. In verse 18, we see Yael's actions. First, she properly greets Sisera, and then in finest Bedouin tradition, offers him more than he asks for. Now, it was obvious to Yael that he was running for his life. So she says to him, "Don't be afraid." The implication being, she and her people would, of course, be a shield for him. He asks to rest. She offers him her own tent, even offers him a blanket. He asks for water. She gives him milk. This is very traditional Bedouin, very traditional in the Middle East to do this. Now, it's been a folk remedy for all cultures that warm milk is soothing. It helps to bring on sleep. In that day, there wasn't such a thing as cold milk. So exhausted, now drowsy from the warm milk, Sisera asks Yael to stand guard at the tent entrance, and if any of the Israelites come looking for him, she's to explain nobody's in her tent. Now, modesty traditions would dictate that if indeed she had said that a male said that to a male Israelite soldier, he would have honored that. He would have not entered this woman's tent. So now, feeling comfortable enough that he's safe, Sisera lies down in Yael's tent, and she covers him up with a blanket. Immediately, he falls asleep. In a very uncharacteristic move, Yael surprises us when she picks up a tent peg and a hammer, steals into her own tent, and when she's assured that Sisera is in a deep sleep, she drives a wooden tent peg through his temple, all the way through his skull and brain and out the other side, such as the peg buries itself in the ground. Death is instantaneous. Sisera doesn't even stir. Now, we should not doubt Yael's ability to pull off such a grisly murder. It was the duty of the nomadic females to disassemble and erect tents. She was handy with that hammer. Yael was an expert with a hammer on those sharp, hardened wooden tent pegs. It would have taken little more than two or three quick strikes with that heavy hammer to drive that tent peg clean through Sisera's sleeping noggin. Thus, in a most unsuspected way, we find that indeed Deborah's prophecy was accurate. Sisera was handed over to a woman, just not the woman that we kind of all expected, and probably Barak expected, maybe even Deborah expected. Needless to say, Yael must not have agreed with her husband's pro-Canaanite viewpoints. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. Well, when the pursuing Barak came to the village of Hever, Yael ran out to meet him, directed him to her tent, and presented him with the skewered corpse. Now the victory was complete. But poor Barak was denied the honor of executing the opposing military commander, as was customary. And this was the result of his doubt when Deborah first presented God's instructions to him. Now, Judges chapter 4 ends with giving all the glory to the God of Israel for this resounding victory and deliverance. This battle was a tipping point. And so a people, the northern Israelite tribes, who had known only humiliation and subjugation for many years, now found their courage and they turned the tables. In a short time, Yavin, king of Hatzar, was no more, and the threat ended. However, this by no means indicates an overall destruction of all the Canaanites, but only those in alliance with the city of Hatzor. So future oppressions and subjugations by various groups of Canaanites were all but assured. Let's move on now to Judges chapter 5, where we get some additional details about this episode. Open your Bibles now to Judges chapter 5. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 274. On that day, Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang this song. When leaders in Israel dedicate themselves and the people volunteer, you should all bless Adonai. Hear, kings, listen, princes. I will sing to Adonai, I will sing praise to Adonai, the God of Israel. Adonai, when you went out from Seir, when you marched out from the field of Edom, the earth quaked and the sky shook, yes, the clouds poured down torrents. The mountains melted at the presence of Adonai at Sinai before Adonai, the God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anat, in the days of Yael, the main roads were deserted. Travelers walked the byways. The rulers ceased in Israel. They ceased until you arose, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. They chose new gods when war was at the gates. Was there a shield or spear to be seen among Israel's 40,000 men? My heart goes out to Israel's leaders and to those among the people who volunteer. All of you, bless Adonai. You who ride white donkeys, sitting on soft saddle blankets, you walking on the road, talk about it. Louder than the sound of archers at the watering holes will they sound as they retell the righteous acts of Adonai, the righteous acts of his rulers in Israel. Then Adonai's people marched down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake, break into song. Arise, Barak. Lead away your captives, son of Abinoam. Then a remnant of the nobles marched down. The people of Adonai marched down to me like warriors. From Ephraim came those rooted in Amalek. Behind you, Benjamin is with your peoples. From Machir, the commanders marched down. From Zebulun, those holding the muster staff. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah, Issachar along with Barak. Into the valley they rushed forth behind him. Among the divisions of Reuben they made great resolutions in their hearts. But why did you stay at the pens for the sheep and listen to the shepherd's flute playing for the flocks? Concerning the divisions of Reuben, there were great searchings of the heart. Gilead lives beyond the Jordan. Dan, why does he stay by the ships? Asher stayed by the shore of the sea, remaining near its bays. The people of Zebulun risked their lives. Naphtali, too, on the open heights. Kings came and they fought. Yes, the kings of Canaan fought at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. But they took no spoil of silver. They fought from heaven, the stars in their courses. Yes, they fought against Sisera. The Kishon River swept them away. That ancient river, the Kishon River. Oh, my soul, march on with strength. Then the horses' hooves pounded the ground, their mighty steeds galloping at full speed. Curse Meroz, said the angel of Adonai. Curse the people living there with a bitter punishment for not coming to help Adonai, to help Adonai against the mighty warriors. Yael will be blessed more than all women. The wife of Hever the Cainy will be blessed more than any women in the tent. He asked for water, she gave him milk. In an elegant bowl, she brought him curds. Then she took a tent peg in her left hand, a workman's hammer in her right, and with the hammer she struck Sisera, pierced his skull. Yes, she shattered and crushed his temple. He sank down at her feet, he fell and lay there. He sank at her feet, he fell. And when he sank down, there he fell. Sisera's mother looks out the window. Peering out through the lattice, she wonders, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why are his horses so slow to return? The wisest of her ladies answers her, and she repeats it to herself. Of course, they're collecting and dividing the spoil. A girl, two girls for every warrior. For Sisera, booty of dyed clothing, a plunder of colorfully embroidered garments, two embroidered scarves for every soldier's neck. May all your enemies perish like this, Adonai. But may those who love him be like the sun going forth in its glory. Then the land had rest for 40 years. And we're not going to get through all this today. We're just going to get started. This chapter is known popularly among Jews and Christians alike as the Song of Deborah. Now, although some modern scholars disagree, the Hebrew sages say that there is no doubt that Deborah herself authored this song, even though, and equally without doubt, some amount of editing was done in the centuries to follow. Before we delve too deeply into the Song of Deborah, a reasonable question right about now ought to be this. Was Yael justified in murdering Sisera in cold blood? After all, the Song of Deborah goes to great length to glorify, let alone justify, Sisera's death. even going so far as to mock Sisera's mother, who waited anxiously at home, scanning the horizon for a son she loved, but a son who would never return to her. I don't think that the moral issue of Yael's actions can be so easily resolved, as some of the well-known Christian scholars claim. The usual take on this in Christian circles is that while the Lord was well aware that Yael would use treachery and murder to end Sisera's life, that it was wrong. C.F. Keel, in his masterly commentary on the book of Judges, sums it up this way. Nevertheless, the act of killing Sisera was not morally justified, either by this prophetic pronouncement or by the fact that it is commemorated in the Song of Deborah. Even though there can be no doubt that Yael acted under the influence of religious enthusiasm for the cause of Israel and of its God, and that she was prompted by religious motivations to regard the connection of her tribe with Israel, the people of the Lord, as higher and more sacred not only than the bond of peace in which her tribe was living with Yavin, the Canaanite king, but even then the duties of hospitality, which are so universally sacred to the Oriental mind that her heroic deed cannot be acquitted of the sins of lying, treachery, and assassination. Now, the Hebrew sages are, as you might suspect, a little bit more tolerant of her actions, although they don't entirely excuse them either. In fact, some very fanciful rabbinical commentaries say that what Yael did first was to seduce Sisera, and she did it 7 times. A couple of quick points to ponder in making your own decision. First, Yael was not an Israelite. Her God was not Yehovah. Second of all, it's very hard to find fault for someone ridding the world of a tyrant by whatever the means. Third, we find Israel used deceit, spying, ambush, the cover of darkness, and other stealthy and grisly means to kill their enemies in a number of biblical situations, and there is no recorded chastisement from the Lord for doing it. Even so, there is some line in the sand, probably that ought not to be crossed, even when dealing with a vicious and heartless enemy. The problem, especially for modern Western Christians, is that this assassination of Sisera by Yael seems so barbaric and horrible compared to our sentiments and sensibilities of morality and fair play. But our sentiments are certainly not the standards of those times and not of Middle Eastern cultures in general. In fact, the Islamic methods that we see depicted today, with beheadings and lopping off of hands and feet for relatively minor crimes, honor killings of fathers upon their daughters who refuse arranged marriages, blood feuds that go on for generations, all this gives us a pretty good picture of ancient Middle Eastern and biblical society in general. Now, of course, with Israel, God ordained a different way than for all other peoples, but not so different as we might suppose. Their general customs still operated very much like their neighbors. Now, while we need to be thoughtful in our assessment of this act of Yael upon Sisera, we also need to note that never did God ordain or direct Yael's actions, even though he foreknew them. In the end, though, followers of the God of Israel are held to a higher standard than those who are not his. Not that a Hebrew woman might not have done exactly as Yael did if she'd had the opportunity. This is where the rabbinical method called Kal Vomer is so valuable for us. The principle of light and heavy. There will always be, in this sinful and fallen world, situations that just don't have good resolutions. Not even for the most pious believers and studied Bible teachers. I have given the example in prior lessons of Corrie ten Boom, who saved many Jewish lives during World War II by blatantly disobeying her government, hiding Jews wanted by the police, and lying as to their whereabouts so as to keep them from the death camps. Yet in both the Old Testament and New Testament, we're told that lying is a sin under any circumstance. And in the New Testament especially, that we're to submit to our governments because human government is ordained by God. For Hebrews, the matter is handled by applying the principle of kol vomer. And thus, the greater good of saving innocent life is weighed against the smaller evil of lying and not submitting to our human authorities, and thus the proper course of action for a God-fearer becomes clear. I think that even though Yael was a pagan, we should likely look upon her murderous actions in the same way. Committing a terrible evil ended an even greater evil. We're going to continue with the Song of Deborah next time we meet.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.